From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Defending those who give the Earth a voice. Today is International Human Rights Day. We'll look at a campaign in defense of environmental activists from around the world who face increased repression from states, often working hand-in-hand with multinational corporations. We'll talk to the daughter of a Soviet submarine captain on trial for espionage as he tries to expose Russia's illegal dumping of nuclear waste, and a human rights activist from Guerrero, Mexico, discussing how anti-logging activists are under threat of death. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The international aid group Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has accepted the 1999 Nobel Peace Prize for its pioneering humanitarian work around the world. The group will use its almost $1 million award money to create a fund to fight killer diseases such as malaria, sleeping sickness, and tuberculosis, which are spreading in poorer countries. At least 18 nations are set to mark International Human Rights Day today by signing a legal protocol that would allow women to file complaints to the United Nations about discrimination, sexual exploitation, and other abuses. The 21-article optional protocol to a 20-year-old women's anti-discrimination treaty was adopted by the UN General Assembly in October and is open for signature at noon. It would enable women for the first time to submit the sexual discrimination complaints directly to the UN, as well as to protest against other violations of the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, a treaty approved by the General Assembly in 1979. The European Union today says seven countries are now eligible to negotiate entry into the organization, but insisted that one of them, Turkey, must first improve its record on human rights. Pro-Jakarta militiamen, armed with pistols and clubs, threatened UN aid officials in Indonesian West Timor today, preventing them from entering camps for East Timorese refugees. Four aid workers were confronted by gangs of armed Indonesian militiamen in two camps on the outskirts of Kupang, the capital of West Timor. More than 100,000 East Timorese are being held in these camps by the Indonesian military. And this news from New York. 1 week after the anti-trade protests in Seattle, more than 1,000 people, union leaders and students, marched in a candlelight rally yesterday to urge retailers such as Nike and The Gap to end child labor and sweatshop abuses. The more than 1,000 students from 50 grammar schools, high schools, and universities carried signs that read, "Gap, will I grow up to be exploited?" or "No more sweatshops, shame on Nike." They protested outside Nike's large Nike Town store and the Disney store as they marched along Fifth Avenue. Students urged consumers to boycott retailers that use sweatshops, mostly found in Central America, Asia, and the Caribbean, to manufacture their goods, and they chanted, "Let your conscience be your fashion guide." Among those in attendance was the president of the AFL-CIO, John Sweeney. This news from Chestertown, Maryland. Two white brothers have been arrested and charged with murdering a 73-year-old black woman riding home with friends from a Christmas shopping trip. Authorities declined to specify a motive, but said the FBI is investigating whether the shooting was racially motivated. Washington State news. The Energy Department plans to designate Washington's Hanford Nuclear Reservation and the Nevada test site as primary permanent disposal sites for low-level and mixed low-level radioactive waste. Both the Hanford site in South Central Washington and the Nevada facility, 65 miles north of Las Vegas, already dispose of low-level and mixed low-level waste generated on-site or shipped from other Energy Department operations. Genetic researchers say they've a recipe to whip up life in a lab from scratch. Researchers at the Institute for Genomic Research say it would take about 300 genes to create a simple one-celled organism. The project is referred to jokingly as Frankencell by Institute researchers who embarked on the project to determine the minimum set of genes needed to build a living organism. The work was halted in 1998 because of ethics concerns. After 31 years in Los Angeles County, the nation's largest gun show is moving to Las Vegas. Great Western Shows says it's moving the event because of a ban on gun sales on county property. Company officials say they've been unable to nail down a contract for the show's Los Angeles site for next year. In September, the county's Board of Supervisors banned the sale of guns and ammunition on county-owned property. The move followed a shooting rampage in which five people were wounded at a Jewish center and a postal worker was shot to death. And finally, the Hawaii Supreme Court has effectively ended the drive to legalize gay marriage in a state once considered one of the most likely to accept same-sex unions. In a ruling yesterday, the court said the effort by homosexual couples was rendered moot by a 98 amendment to the state constitution overwhelmingly approved by voters.
Yes, we are rising up, rising from the depth of our despair. Women of the world, we're from the east, south, north, and west. We are women of the world. We're from the mountains, the valleys, the cities, and the farms. We are women of the world. We're from poverty, illiteracy, circumcision, shame. We are women of the world. We are housewives, nine-to-fives, mothers displaced. We are women of the world. And we're coming from Beijing, ready for change. We are rising up, rising from the depth of our despair.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today is International Human Rights Day, the 51st anniversary of the signing of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Debate over the meaning of human rights is being shaped these days by factors such as globalization, militarism, and corporate exploitation. Last week in Seattle, the debate took center stage as tens of thousands of activists from all over the world took to the streets of the city in protest of the World Trade Organization's exclusion of human rights, environmental rights, and labor rights from its trade agenda. The protesters particularly emphasized the WTO's negative impact on the environment as member countries and multinational corporations shape the agenda to seek to liberalize trade in such areas as fishing, logging, and bioengineered crops, which they say would result in overfishing and deforestation, as well as other unforeseen consequences. Well, yesterday in Washington, D.C., Amnesty International and the Sierra Club launched a joint project called Defending Those Who Give Earth a Voice. This in defense of people who are being persecuted, beaten, harassed, imprisoned, tortured, and murdered by governments that are defending the interests of multinational corporations. We're joined by a host of people who are involved in this campaign, and we're going to start with Ellen Dorsey, who is the coordinator of Amnesty International's Environmental Human Rights Program. Can you tell us what the campaign is all about, Ellen?
Well, we've come together in this unprecedented collaboration between Amnesty International and the Sierra Club to demonstrate a combined constituency for the protection of human rights of environmental activists and communities at risk that are resisting often large-scale development projects, plans by multinational corporations to extract their resources, and other environmentally destructive policies by governments. It's really fundamentally a PowerPoint. With the consolidation of capital and rapid economic globalization, it's critical that our key social movements come together to really answer power with power and to build globalization from below. Amnesty and the Sierra Club together have a combined 1 million member constituency, and we plan to organize that constituency in thousands more.
You're also joined by Steve Mills of the Sierra Club. Can you talk about the various issues that you've taken up? It's very significant, especially for Amnesty International, which is, to say the least, very conservative on the issue of corporations, takes on countries, but has been in the past not willing to take on corporations. What are the corporations you're willing to name?
Well, Amy, we've actually named several corporations in our report. And what we're going to be doing is organizing our members to write letters, and we'll be organizing pressure in Washington with elected officials to address these corporations. Some of the corporations we name, you've talked about on this show before. I believe I've talked about them with you. Certainly Shell in Nigeria. Chevron's had some problems. We look at Unocal in Burma. There's some foreign corporations as well, a host of them. But what the campaign is really about is raising the bar for all corporations so that whether they're operating in the U.S. or abroad, they're held to the same higher standard that respects both human rights and the environment.
So let's take it case by case, from Chad to China, Kenya, Ecuador, India, Nigeria. Ellen Dorsey.
Well, again, I'd like to reiterate what Steve said is that the cases that we name in this report are chosen to represent a global pattern of abuses. They're certainly not exhaustive or a comprehensive list. So I think it's important to recognize that we will be campaigning on other cases as well through the course of our activities over the next 2 years. And for Amnesty, it is pathbreaking that we are moving in this direction. And I think it's perfectly appropriate on Human Rights Day, sitting at the edge of the next century, that we're showing how we're taking on the economic actors. In Chad, Cameroon, there's a pipeline that has been proposed. Exxon is one of the critical players in it, and we're calling on Exxon to develop a new consultation process with the affected communities, and to agree to this new consultation process and commit to the protection of basic human rights. We're also asking that they reveal the terms under which the company has hired private security firms to protect their operations in Chad and Cameroon. These are two of extremely repressive countries. There have already been instances of human rights violations in the area where the pipeline is to be built, and we're concerned about the role that private security forces could play in protecting the facilities if communities begin to peacefully protest.
Ecuador and China, Steve Mills.
Ecuador and China. Certainly in Ecuador we look at oil issues, oil exploration issues. In China we have development issues where their institutional reform is needed in groups like the World Bank and so forth. But I think what's important, Amy, is that not only corporations are not addressed in every single chapter here. We're looking at getting pressure on governments as well. Certainly the issue we're going to hear about soon in Russia does not involve corporate issues and in Mexico. So we're looking at getting not only the U.S. government, but foreign governments as well to respect and improve their human rights and environmental protection.
Steve Mills, you've been known working within Sierra Club to specifically look at Chevron and Shell Oil in Nigeria. Can you talk specifically
right
about each of these corporations and what they've done?
Well, certainly the Sierra Club has had a much larger campaign on, against Shell. We still engage in a boycott of the company. And I was in Nigeria this past July, just to follow up, since there's been a democratic transition there. There is optimism now with the new government, but there's still a lot of frustration. There's still a lot of anger in the Delta. For too long, the communities in the Delta have been ignored. They have not been on the receiving end of the economic windfall that certainly the military generals saw during the Abacha regime. So there's still a lot to be addressed there, and everyone's optimistic that President Obasanjo is going to do that now.
It's interesting in the last weeks to see in the Niger Delta continued massive killing. In fact, the Nigerian military, even with the new president, Obasanjo, cracking down and further militarizing the whole area. So as the New York Times and other mainstream papers extol the virtues of a new democratic government, the crackdown in the Delta continues and scores of people are being killed, Steve.
No, you're right, and it's unfortunate. I think everyone underestimated the level of frustration in the Delta. Certainly those of us who've been there, Amy, you included, recognize this. And that's, you know, we saw development plans one after another when after Abacha died that ignored the Delta. And I think finally there's been some recognition that this is the lifeblood of Nigeria, and so much depends on what happens in the Delta that many countries, the rest of Africa really is dependent on what happens in the Niger Delta, because that's the economic lifeblood of the country. And the communities there have to be a part of that. They have to be a part of the environmental cleanup and the economic improvements.
You know, Steve, the Sierra Club last week was represented at the World Trade Organization meetings in Washington State in Seattle. Now, President Clinton came to town under tremendous fire from environmentalists for not including environmental issues in the trade agenda that has been pushed to be imposed around the world. Clinton kept saying he was going to be meeting with environmental groups, and no one knew who he was meeting with. On Thursday, I went to Charlene Barshefsky, the U.S. Trade Representative's news conference. Still, we didn't know if Clinton had met with anyone. And in passing reference, they mentioned Carl Pope of the Sierra Club and said they had met with him the night before. I think a lot of grassroots activists did not want to give a sort of good housekeeping seal of approval to what President Clinton and the U.S. administration was doing. What about the Sierra Club's meeting with the administration, and what did you get out of that meeting?
Well, we meet with administrations all the time, and certainly the Sierra Club was not the only environmental group in the room there. There were a host of groups. It's the Sierra Club is sort of the brand name, though, when it comes to the environment, so that's who's most often mentioned. I think everyone could see we didn't get a whole lot. The president has made some remarks that's given us all hope, but I think that it needs to trickle down through the rest of his administration.
We're going to move on to talk about some of the different areas that you focused on. Among those areas are Russia and Guerrero. When we talk about Guerrero, we'll be speaking with a human rights activist who is in the studio in Washington. And we're also going to be talking with a Russian human rights activist who is joining us in the studio in Washington, D.C. on behalf of her father. We're joined by Julia Chernova, the daughter of Alexander Nikitin. In July of 1992, Alexander Nikitin, a nuclear engineer and submarine captain, was charged for the eighth time with espionage for blowing the whistle on illegal nuclear waste dumping. Nikitin co-authored a report called The Russian Northern Fleet, Sources of Radioactive Contamination, which documented the problems of radioactive pollution from mothballed nuclear submarines. Since writing the report, human rights groups say he's been continuously harassed by the government. Julia, we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning. Yes. First of all, I want to thank Sierra Club and Amnesty International, and we are very excited that they joined their forces in trying to prevent human rights violation and environmental, decide a bunch of environmental issues. My father is permanently under harassment of the security service in Russia, and unfortunately, he's still under house arrest, and he could not leave and sit and represent here himself. So that's basically what I'm doing here.
Well, Julia, we are going to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we come back. We want to find out what it is that he exposed in Russia and the trial that he faces now for espionage. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! The exception to the rulers today is International Human Rights Day. It is the 51st anniversary of the signing of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Our guest in the studio, Julia Chernova, daughter of Alexander Nikitin, who's a nuclear engineer on trial for espionage in Russia. He's a former Soviet submarine captain. And he's on trial for exposing Russia's illegal dumping of nuclear waste. Can you tell us his story, Julia?
Yes. My father was working together with Norwegian environmental organization Bellona. And in 1995, actually, they published a report about nuclear waste dumping and contamination in the northern region of Russia. Bellona was really interested in the issue because of the Russian northern fleet contamination would affect the entire northern Europe. So the report was published, actually it was ready to be published, but in October of 95, FSB service, FSB people came to our place and searched a place. They turned upside down everything. They took away our passports, all kind of papers they found. They took away everything. And actually, they took away my father, but at that time, he came back in the morning. But they kept taking him. They kept taking him to FSB office for kind of questioning. And on February 1996, in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, they came to our place, and they said that they're gonna take him for questioning once again, and he'll be back in a couple of hours. But he got back home after 9 months spending in prison. And he finally got home, but he's still under home house arrest, and he's not allowed to leave. But the thing that we got him back, he's safe. We can contact, communicate. He keep doing his work. This is a big thanks to all international organization, all international support we got. He keeps working on the same issues, and also right now he's in a trial that started November 23rd. It's the eighth trial already, but we hope very much that it's going to be the last one, and we will get conclusion from a judge between Christmas, between 25th and New Year. Lawyers, they're rather optimistic, and everybody hopes that charges finally will be dropped.
Can you explain where the nuclear waste is being dumped?
Yes, the main issues is what was going on the Kola Peninsula, Severodvinsk. A few submarines dozed out of service, but they still kept all that used fuel, and it contaminates the region. And this is what my father called the Chernobyl in slow motion.
What made your father decide to speak out?
He used to be a naval officer for many years. He saw what's going on. He knows how it affects people, how it affects environment, that kids that grown up there, they drinking polluted water. All of us breathe that air with all those radioactive contamination. People live there, people go, and the kids, they playing around, they go to the forest, they pick up mushrooms, berries. Everything is contaminated, and in some areas it's incredibly contamination level, it's incredibly high, and if gonna be no measures taken, the whole area will be just a disaster. It's already a disaster. It's already an environmental disaster.
Hmm. Now, he saw these terrible things before him,
yes.
But it takes a special person to speak out against his government and face the kind of consequences he's facing, being on trial now for espionage.
Yes, there have been other people who also knew what's going on, but somehow he was the first who started it, and he started speaking loud about it. And people, his friends, naval officers, they still actually in the military, and they support him. They support him a lot. Everybody knows what's going on, but it just took a time to start speaking about it.
Julia Chernova, guest, daughter of Alexander Nikitin, on trial for espionage for exposing Russia's illegal dumping of nuclear waste. What effect has it had on you and your family, Julia?
We were under permanent pressure from FSB. They followed us everywhere. Since we didn't realize it first. We thought it's a mistake when they did a search in our place, in our apartment. They also did the same thing in the office of Beluna in Murmansk, and some people who supported that report gave some hand on writing that report about contamination. And then we realized that it's not going to stop. It's not a mistake. They continuously making the pressure. They following us everywhere. We're out of our place. Like, I'm going to school, or my parents going to work, and somebody, like, in a 10 minutes, somebody else in our place, and they're searching for something else. There is a bug. Our place is bugged. I think it still is. And phone is taping the mail, prostrating. There's email messages that I never get. They're just disappearing, especially if it's something important in it. There are fax messages that spend like a couple of days between two fax machines. And lawyers, there was a few cases when they threatened our lawyers. They were saying, like, you better stay away from this case if you want to still be alive. And they damaged our cars, wrecked our cars. They punctured tires. They put a glue in the lock. They did something to the brakes. So it just was really dangerous. And that pressure, they wanted us to know that we are under control, like under a microscope, every minute of our life. And it's just scary. They've been waiting for me near the door of my university when I was going to gym. There was a few times that they tried to involve my dad in a car accident, and actually he got hit by a car once. He put his car in a parking lot and was crossing the road, go home. And there was a car parked a few meters ahead, and suddenly that car backed up and hit him and went away. There was another case when he was already home, and as far as he is under house arrest, every time he has to go somewhere, whether it's an environmental meeting, press conference in another city, he has to ask permission. And there was a time when he has his mother and some other relatives in Ukraine, and he didn't see them for a few years. So he really had to go visit them. He asked permission. He was given permission. But there was incredible story happened on his way back. He was arrested on a train on a tiny station somewhere in the forest in the middle of nowhere. He was taken down to some kind of police department. And they kept him there for like a couple of hours till his train was gone. And they said, now you're free to go. He said, excuse me, where can I go? And there was no other train. He didn't have money for a ticket. He just couldn't do anything. And thanks God, there was another like tiny like diesel or something. So they just pick him up. Otherwise, we just can't. I just want to think what would happen. Yeah. We probably would never see him again because pretty sure everything was planned.
Julia, will you suffer repercussions?
Some journalists say no person, no case. That's probably what FSB wants.
Will you suffer repercussions for coming to the United States to speak about your father's case?
No, actually right now I live in the United States. I'm studying. I wasn't able to study at home, and I got this opportunity here. So I study in Boston now.
Well, I want to thank you
but
for sharing your story. Any last thoughts?
No, just thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Julia Chernova, daughter of Alexander Nikitin, a nuclear engineer and former Soviet submarine captain, currently on trial for espionage for helping to expose Russia's illegal dumping of nuclear waste. We're now going to turn to another area of the world, to Mexico. While many people by now have heard of human rights abuses committed in the state of Chiapas, Mexico, by Mexican military, police, and paramilitary forces as they take on the Zapatistas, few may know about what's happening in the state of Guerrero. Perhaps the only point of reference for Guerrero for many people is its most famous city, Acapulco, a tourist resort for millions of Americans. But it's also one of the poorest states in Mexico. It's wrought with state violence and guerrilla fighting, and for several years, national and transnational timber companies have been stripping the forests of the Sierra Madre, prompting many local peasants to hold peaceful protests to halt mass logging there. The logging has been sped up since the implementation of NAFTA on January 1, 1994, when Mexico repealed the constitutional rights to communal land ownership, eliminated restrictions on foreign ownership of property, and relaxed environmental regulations. The changes paved the way for one of the largest timber companies in the world, the Idaho-based Boise Cascade, to make a 5-year deal with the Mexican government in 1995, forcing local mills to dramatically increase their local production. Boise Cascade left Mexico last year. Well, according to Amnesty International and the Sierra Club, the peasants' protests have been answered with extrajudicial executions, torture, rape, and arbitrary arrests by the Mexican military against members of the largely indigenous communities. In an Amnesty report has been put out, in June of 1995, 17 unarmed peasants were massacred in Guerrero by members of the state judicial police after they gathered to protest the governor's decision to resume logging in the area. And just a few months ago, on May 2nd, the Mexican military arrested anti-logging activists Rodolfo Montiel Flores and Teodoro Cabrero Garcia. Both are members of the Sierra de Petlatan and Cocuya de Catalan, a local environmental organization that opposes logging in the region. The state attorney's office has called them members of an ecological guerrilla organization. Well, today we're joined in the studio by Dina Ochoa y Placido, who is coordinator of the law program of the Human Rights Center, Agustin Pro Juarez, an organization that's taken on the legal defense of the two men. And this past August, she was kidnapped for several hours and beaten, an act of intimidation against her for activities in Guerrero. She's in our Washington studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dina.
Gracias por la invitación.
Thank you for the invitation.
Bueno, yo estoy ahora para
I'm here
hablar sobre el
to speak
caso
about the case
Rodolfo
of Rodolfo Montiel
and Teodoro Cabrera. Two members of the organization
of campesino ecologists of the Sierra de Petatlán in Guerrero. These campesinos, to organize themselves and defend their forests in a peaceful manner, have been persecuted, harassed, threatened, and jailed unjustly, and also illegally processed. Some of them have even been executed. Rodolfo Montiel was one of the leaders of the organization. Because of this, he was detained by the members of the Mexican military on the 2nd of May in this year. When they were detained by the members of the Mexican military, Rodolfo Montiel and Teodoro Cabrera were tortured, severely tortured. They were especially threatened with being executed and tortures in various parts of their body. Reasons for because of this right now they're suffering serious consequences to their health. Just yesterday they told me in Mexico City, another of my work colleagues told me that Teodoro Cabrera right now is really sick in the prison in Iguala, Guerrero. And this is because of the torture that he received. The problem right now is actually in his testicles, which where he was really beaten by the members of the Mexican military. The Mexican military in the Sierra de Guerrero, or actually in the whole state of Guerrero, use as a pretext and like investigating guerrilla groups and drug trafficking, have committed many injustices against indigenous and campesinos in Guerrero. The campesino organization is known, and they have done a lot of legal processes. They have gone to government organizations of the state and federal authorities in Mexico to ask them to stop cutting down their forests, especially because in their communities they've begun to suffer the consequences, like the rivers running dry. Some rivers have actually dried out, and some springs of water have also dried out. This has created the fertility of the land has diminished. Because of this, the campesinos aren't producing enough to feed their families. Because of this just fight that they're fighting and legal, the campesinos are being threatened by being threatened to be detained. And in the case of Rodolfo and Teodoro, the same military also planted on them guns and drugs to be able to take them away from their activism in the fight of their organization. It's because of this that in this moment they're in a legal process that's unjust.
Let me ask, we called Boise Cascade yesterday and asked them to join us for the show, the large logging company in Boise, Idaho, and they said they have nothing to do with whatever these allegations are, that they didn't even know about these two men who were arrested and that they left Mexico last year. Dina Ochoa y Placido, what is your response to that?
Well, I think that the ecological organization of the Sierra de Petatlán was actually formed when one of the companies that was there, that was in these communities, was Boise Cascade, among other ones. Those who directly could feel affected by the actions of this organization, because the organization was able to stop the wood from coming down from the mountains. And so, among other ones, it is Boise Cascade. It's one of the caciques, like the caciques, the leaders of the area, and the authorities that are also directly involved. They feel affected that their economic interests have been affected. And it's because of this, in this moment, the persecution of these men began. If even the detention of Rodolfo and Teodoro was the 2nd of May of this year, since last year, they had been threatened and harassed. Rodolfo Montiel had even been detained and tortured by the militaries. And they threatened to kill him and to kill his family if he had denounced what they did. What the militaries wanted was that he left the ecological organization. If I can't say that Boise Cascade directly was threatening the ecologists, I can say it was one of the companies that really felt affected by the activities of the ecologists. And this speaks for itself.
Dina Choi Placido, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. She is coordinator of the law program of the Human Rights Center, Agustin Prohorez, which is based in Guerrero. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by the Bishop of Guerrero to talk about the overall conditions there, one of the poorest states in Mexico. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue on this International Human Rights Day, talking about human rights violations and human rights defenders around the world. You hear noise in the background because actually it's a translator here in the studios in New York translating what I'm saying to the Bishop of Guerrero who has come up to the United States and can describe the conditions in Guerrero. We hear a lot about Chiapas and the Zapatistas. Well, there are guerrillas in Guerrero as well, and there are serious human rights abuses there. It is an area we know much more because it is the site of Acapulco, but it is also a state that contains much more. And by the way, the report that has come out from Amnesty International and Sierra Club is called Defending Those Who Give the Earth a Voice. And if you want to get the full report and look at the countries that they focused on and the human rights defenders that they highlight, you can go to their website at www.amnesty-usa.org/justearth. That's amnesty-usa.org/justearth. But in the studio with us now in New York is Bishop Alejo Zavala Castro from Guerrero, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much
por darnos oportunidad,
for giving us the opportunity
de
of speaking of our state of Guerrero.
Precisamente, hemos venido.
We have come here
con el padre César,
with Father
César,
the director of the local seminary,
convivir
to share
con mucha gente
with a lot of the people
que vive en Guerrero,
who lived in Guerrero,
y que ha tenido que emigrar,
but they've had to migrate
por las situaciones
because of the situations
que vivimos en el estado de Guerrero.
That we live in the state of Guerrero.
Sabemos que
we know
en Estados Unidos,
that in the United States
y en muchas partes
and in many other places
del mundo,
of the world,
conocen Acapulco.
They are familiar with Acapulco.
Pero para nosotros,
but for us,
quienes vivimos allá,
we who live in the state,
sabemos
we know
que Guerrero,
that Guerrero
no es Acapulco,
is not Acapulco.
Que precisamente Acapulco,
that exactly Acapulco
es el extremo,
is one extreme
la mayor parte del estado.
In terms of one part of the state.
La pobreza,
the poverty,
que extrema, que
extreme poverty,
en muchas casos,
in
muchos
many
casos,
cases,
llegan a la miseria,
leads to misery.
Viene de mucho tiempo antes.
This has come back a long way in history.
Y esto,
and this
ha despertado,
has awakened
situaciones,
situations
muy especiales,
that are very special
en todo nuestro estado,
in all of our state.
Situaciones de violencia,
situations of violence,
situaciones de impunidad,
situations of impunity.
Y ante estas situaciones,
and in the face of these kinds of situations,
estoy hablando de la pobreza extrema,
I'm speaking of the extreme poverty.
Tenemos en el estado de Guerrero,
in the state of Guerrero,
dos de los municipios más pobres,
two of the poorest municipalities of the whole country.
Han surgido,
there have emerged
ante esta situación,
in the face of the situation that worries us, it concerns the state,
a la comunidad,
and the communities,
y a la iglesia,
and the church.
De parte del estado, de la federación,
on the part of the national government,
les preocupa,
it says it's concerned.
Que esta sea una situación muy parecida a la de Chiapas.
They say our situation is very similar
muchas,
to what happened in Chiapas.
Y a otras muchas de nuestra patria,
and there's other places like it in the country.
La federación,
I have a question.
Yo tengo una pregunta.
In the case of Chiapas,
in el caso de Chiapas,
I went down to Chiapas at the beginning of the uprising of the Zapatistas and saw the kind of pressure the bishop of San Cristobal de las Casas, Bishop Ruiz, was under. What kind of pressure are you under to come here and to speak out about the poverty and the violence against the people of Guerrero?
Entendí la pregunta. ¿Presión de parte de quién?
Well, pressure from whom?
The government.
Del gobierno, por ejemplo.
Or others.
O otros.
Bueno, hasta ahorita no he recibido ninguna presión.
Well,
y
up until now, I haven't been pressured.
De una realidad,
I think talking today about the reality.
Nadie. Mi intención no es molestar a nadie.
I'm not trying to upset anyone.
Una realidad.
I'm just trying to clarify the reality.
Can you talk about the militarization of Guerrero?
Sí, decía hace un momento,
well, I was saying a few moments ago,
el estado y la federación,
the government at the state level and the federal level has tried to respond.
Una de ellas, programas,
one of those responses has been programs that have tried to bring progress, but they haven't worked.
Situación del medio ambiente,
in terms of the environment, etc.
Pues el del sistema,
and because of the very system.
Entonces, el gobierno,
and so
y
the government
estado,
and the state
intentado esto nuevo, esta nuevo
has tried this new means, which is militarization.
Pues en Guerrero, cada día se
in
nota
Guerrero,
más.
You can notice this every day a little
en,
more.
En Tlapa, en la ciudad,
in Tlapa, the city
pueblo donde nosotros vivimos,
where we live,
acaban de establecer un cuartel con
they just
muchos,
established a new barracks
militares.
With many, many soldiers.
In April of 1999, the army was involved in the killing of a man and his child. Can you talk about that? And what were the circumstances?
I'm familiar with the case. I think it was a mistake. I don't have the exact information with me. This is being, has been registered in our Diocesan Human Rights Center. I can't give you all the exact information right now, but I am familiar with the case.
Mm-hmm. What do you think people in the United States can do about what's happening in Guerrero today?
One of the reasons why we came is precisely to awaken the awareness, especially of the people who are from there but who now live up here, but also those who are from there that live here. We are hoping that there will be an intervention by other governments, the governments of this nation and other nations, so that they can help us to overcome this kind of situation.
What do you think people in solidarity here in particular could do in the United States?
I think precisely to support the demonstrations. The 2 days that we are here, for example, we've heard of several demonstrations that are taking place in favor of the rights of people from Mexico or Guerrero, especially now with the Virgin of Guadalupe fiestas coming about. There's a certain fervor that has started, and there's a desire that villages overcome the situations in which they live. So I'd like all these people to be united and to be in solidarity and to look for responses, not in a violent fashion, but in a peaceful way. And that the citizens of the United States and New York, that they do us the favor of supporting as well and listening to the complaints of the people in these demonstrations.
Will we see as mass an uprising in Guerrero as we've seen in Chiapas? In Chiapas, it's called the Zapatistas, the guerrilla movement. You also have guerrillas in Guerrero.
There have been some demonstrations
of the community
because of the sense of impotence they feel in terms of the responses of the government. And concretely, since several years now, two armed groups have come about looking to the way of violence solutions to their difficulties. These movements, I'm sure you're familiar with them. One is the ERPI, and the other is the EPR.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with the Bishop of Guerrero. He is Bishop Alejo Zavala Castro. And as we wrap up today's program, after this musical break, we are going to end on a lighter note on International Human Rights Day, and that is an excerpt of a speech by Michael Moore, the other Michael Moore, you might say the real Michael Moore, not the Director General of the World Trade Organization, but the media activist who went to Seattle to challenge the World Trade Organization.
The president signed a GATT treaty into law. Fast act to Congress with only hours of debate. We ceded our authority in the blink of an eye to a group of corporations that purchased the right. They call it free trade. I'll tell you what that means. Get out of your unions here. But the factories overseas putting poisons in the water and pay pennies would be sold.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is media activist Michael Moore, who spoke at the Key Arena before more than 10,000 people last week in Seattle, Washington.
What I want to know is, what idiot at the WTO decided to have this thing in Seattle? I mean, were they just like sitting around one day at the WTO building and, well, we got to go have a meeting. Where should we go? You know, we could go to Fort Lauderdale. Nah, it's too warm down there. And we could go to San Diego. No, too much sun. Where could we go? Hey, I know. Let's go to Seattle and have the shit kicked out of us. Yeah! You know, at moments like that, there is a God in heaven when things like this happen, right? I don't know. So, this is really an incredible turnout, and I think that the what's going to happen here this week really is a historic event, because the corporations that run this world and their employees, usually known as governments, have decided to come out of the closet, and they thought that they could get away with just creating this merger of the political entities with the corporate entities into just one corporate state that would rule the world. And they thought they could get away with it and nobody would say anything about it. And the big mistake that they made was they just got so damn greedy while they were doing it, you know? And it's really incredible that you've all shown up here in Seattle to participate in this, and to, for all the people who can't be here because they have to go to work tomorrow or they couldn't make the trip across the country, the fact that each of you represent thousands of other people around this country and around the world who are sick and tired of what's going on. About 14 years ago, I bought a suit, and and I put it on to sneak into a meeting that was being held down in Mexico. It was sponsored by the United States Department of Commerce. And the purpose of the meeting was to invite American businessmen to Mexico to teach them how they could close down their factories in the United States and move them to Mexico with the assistance of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And so I went in as a small auto parts businessman into this meeting, attending various seminars on how to screw the workers in my company and how I can exploit the workers down in Mexico. And it was a fascinating thing to see. And they took us around to some of the very first maquiladora factories, the free trade. This is pre-NAFTA, pre-GATT, pre-everything, to show us just how wonderful it was to help raise the standard of living of the Mexican people. And they promised us that if we just allowed more trade to take place, more of these factories to open, that sooner or later the Mexican people would be living just like the people in the United States and in Canada. Well, 14 years later, we went down there again this year on our TV show, The Awful Truth, to see how things were doing. And you know what? Nobody was driving around in a BMW. They weren't swimming in the backyard pool. They weren't barbecuing on a Sunday and having play dates with the kids next door. They were living the same damn pitiful, exploited lives that they were living 14 years ago when this whole mess started. It was a big lie then. It's a big lie now. And the only difference is now the people know it. The people know it's the lie. They've been caught. They've been caught. And you're the people who have caught them doing this.
Michael Moore speaking last week in Seattle, Washington, just before the battle in Seattle. And that does it for today's program, our special on International Human Rights Day. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, and thank you to Joe Gill in Washington, D.C., I'm Amy Goodman.